Sie hören eine Aufnahme des Kepler Salon Linz vom 18.06.2012 zum Thema Was ist Social Impact Investing? Die Charlie Kleissner Story. Zu Gast ist Charlie Kleissner, Impact Investor. Gastgeberin ist Christine Heiden.
Geschätzte Damen und Herren, herzlich willkommen im Kepler Salon. Ich freue mich, dass Sie unsere Sauna heute gewählt haben und nicht die eines Gastgartens irgendwo in der Stadt. Wir hoffen, dass wir alle mit dem Kreislauf gut durchkommen, aber ich glaube, wir haben ein spannendes Thema und einen sehr interessanten Gast heute Abend. Mein Name ist Christine Heiden, ich darf Sie durch den Abend begleiten. Wenn Sie dem Hitzeschlag noch vorbeugen wollen durch kühlende Getränke, der Herr Keinzel ist hinten und serviert Ihnen gerne etwas und Sie kennen ja den Hausbrauch. Sie können auch jederzeit sich etwas holen. Wir haben, wenn wir die Zeitungen aufschlagen, ja praktisch täglich die Meldungen über unser Wirtschafts- und Finanzsystem, verbunden mit der Frage nicht nur, wie lösen wir die momentane Krise, sondern wie entwickeln wir dieses ganze System eigentlich weiter? Was kann aus unserer Art zu wirtschaften in Zukunft eigentlich werden? Unser heutiger Gast beschäftigt sich mit dieser Frage ganz intensiv und ich darf ihn sehr herzlich begrüßen. Es ist Dr. Charlie Kleissner. Herzlich willkommen in Linz.
Dankeschön.
Ich darf Ihnen unseren Gast kurz vorstellen und dazu eine persönliche Bemerkung machen. Wir haben im Vorjahr, glaube ich, ungefähr um die gleiche Zeit ein Interview gemacht und ich habe jetzt das Gefühl, es fehlt eigentlich eine Hälfte, denn das Interview hat zusammen mit seiner Frau Lisa stattgefunden und die beiden sind eigentlich auch in diesem Bereich, um den es heute geht, als Paar unterwegs und ich denke, das ist auch eine Form, die aus dieser gemeinsamen Geschichte unter anderem gewachsen ist. Charlie Kleissner, man darf ihn amikal so nennen, in Wirklichkeit Dr. Karl Kleissner, ist Tiroler, stammt aus Innsbruck, hat in Wien studiert und noch während seiner Mittelschulzeit, wenn ich mich recht erinnere, während eines Austauschaufenthalts auf Hawaii seine spätere Frau kennengelernt. Er hat dann in Wien an der Uni Informatik studiert. Und seine Frau, die Architektin ist, kam dann nach Österreich. Dort wurde eine Familie gegründet und nach etlichen Jahren hat man gesehen, so ganz funktioniert das in Österreich nicht mit den großen Zukunftsperspektiven, vor allem für Lisa Kleissner. Und dann sind die beiden zurück nach Amerika, nach Silicon Valley und dort hat dann die große Geschichte begonnen, von der wir heute auch hören werden. Charlie Kleissner war in der Zeit dieser wirklich großen Entwicklungen dort mit dabei, war bei Firmen wie Ariba, Next Digital Equipment oder Hewlett Packard und wenn Sie so ein iPhone in der Tasche haben, dann haben Sie wahrscheinlich ein Betriebssystem, das auf Charlie Kleissner unter anderem auch zurückgeht in Ihren Apparaten. Also Sie haben ihn sozusagen täglich mit sich. Diese Karriere hat dazu geführt, um es etwas salopp zu sagen, dass Sie plötzlich viel mehr Geld hatten, als Sie brauchen konnten. Und als Sie ausgeschieden sind aus diesem Business in Silicon Valley, war dann die Frage, was tun mit dem Geld und was tun mit der Welt? Und dann ist das entstanden, worüber wir heute reden, Social Impact Investing, und zwar in einer vollkommen neuen und relativ komplexen Situation und auch mit einem dezidierten Ziel, nämlich unsere Form zu wirtschaften à la longue wirklich langfristig und grundlegend auch zu verändern. Worum es da genau geht und was das genau ist, das hören wir jetzt. Charlie Kleissner spricht natürlich perfekt Deutsch, weil er ja das doch gelernt hat. Möchte aber gerne am Anfang Englisch reden. Ich denke, es gibt wahrscheinlich kein Problem. Sonst bitte ich einfach um ein Handzeichen, dann versuchen wir das gleich zu erklären. Bitte, also herzlich willkommen und wir sind neugierig, was es alles zu sagen gibt.
Well, thank you so much for the kind introduction. And I chose to use English for the first remarks, maybe for the first 15 minutes, to explain a little bit the history and the story behind how we got to impact investing, why we do impact investing, what it is, give you some examples, and then have more conversational discussions around this, where I might try to respond to your questions in German, and we'll just do whatever we can. And so I want to start where you stopped, in essence.
Okay.
Because you already told us how I went from Innsbruck to Vienna and then to Hawaii and back, and I almost became a professor at the TU Wien, but I'm not really that great of a professor. I just barely made my PhD, and I'm not the best researcher, right? And when I went to Silicon Valley and got my first job with Hewlett Packard, I was a decent engineer, but in Silicon Valley you have the best engineers of the planet. And so fortunately for me, Hewlett Packard found out that maybe they should make me a manager, and so they made me a manager. And I know how to talk to engineers, I understand them, I can translate what they do into real English, into real, you know, whatever is needed. And that was my core competency. So I was able to actually lead engineering teams in Silicon Valley to success. And one of the teams, of course, was at Next, the operating system team, and with Steve Jobs. And I learned how to do very, very high-performance teams. Teams that otherwise, you know, what motivates them? How do you get the best out of it? How do you do that? And I was able to combine that with my knowledge in distributed systems to implement, you know, the biggest transaction system on the planet with Ariba. So that's sort of, I self-actualized, if you wish, all the things that I really wanted to in my 30s and early 40s. So in 1998, I think Ariba went public, initial public offering, and even so, at that point in time, we already had quite a bit of wealth, but that created, you know, extreme wealth for not only the people who invested in Ariba, but also us, because I owned 1.75% of the company. That's how Silicon Valley works. And I thought that maybe with that money, I might be able to pay for the education of the kids, which is very, very expensive in the U.S. And it turns out that it was a lot more. So I want to talk about the motivation, then maybe stop a little bit to see where you want to go. And because in 2002, Lisa already retired in 2000, and I want to actually give her a lot more credit than you even gave her. It's too bad that she's not here, because we have done much everything together since 2002. We have our own core competencies, but the whole impact investing strategy and how we do this is really a joint effort, and it has been very rewarding to both of us to be able to do that, not without difficulties to adjust and make sure that we do this, and we can talk about this maybe in our conversation. We have a family coach that enables us to be proactive about this, but we do it together. So when I decided not to continue being an executive in 2002, and that's an explicit decision that was based on the assessment that we don't need more money. And most people in my situation actually decide to continue working. And the reason, I think, is because you're at the top of your game and everybody caters to your ego. They say, Charlie, you're so great. You know, I can give you the next job. You can do whatever you want. And you say, no, I don't want to do what you want me to do. I want to figure out what I want to do with the rest of my life. And what is the purpose? That why did so much wealth end up in our laps, right? And so Lisa and I started reflecting on this with meditation and yoga and all sorts of different methodologies. And through that, I certainly discovered what the purpose of my life is and what the purpose of our lives jointly, partially, where we interact is. And that's that I want to make a meaningful contribution to the sustainability of humanity and the planet. And I express that through my talents and my wealth by directing the investment side of the capital that we have into positive impact, by helping the investees, the social entrepreneurs, be more impactful, and thirdly, by doing things like this, hoping to inspire my peers to lead by example and move ultimately more money into meaning. The second motivation, and then I'm going to stop, is really that you hinted at this a little bit when you look at the state of the state, the state of the planet, and you look out 30 years, and you say we will predictably have 9 billion people, give or take 200 million, in 2050. Now, resource constraints is a fact if you have 9 billion people. You need to manage resources very differently, all the way from sustainable agriculture to sustainable timber, sustainable carbon, to everything needs to be rethought in order to have a decent life for 9 billion people. Otherwise, we run the risk that 1 billion, us who live in Europe and North America, have a decent life, but 8 billion don't, right? And so capitalism, as it stands, really does not deal with what's referred to as externalities to the system. Externalities, arguably the biggest externality that's not taken care of is climate change. Climate change is happening despite capitalism and the market forces. So that proves that capitalism as it stands and the market forces are not able to alleviate the issues that the macroeconomists conveniently call externalities. So we need to make them internalities, part of the system. On the sustainability side, you know, that's happening a little bit. We can talk about which investments have provided superior financial returns because the market starts understanding that. But on the social side, I think we're 10, 15 years behind the market understanding. We believe, Lisa and I believe, that the planet would still be an unsustainable planet in 10, 15, 20 years if we have these extreme social injustices, even if we would take care of some of the resources and the resource constraints. So that's the motivation that drives us and why we do the things that we do.
Mm-hmm. And what other things you do?
What other things you do, yeah. We align our whole lives according to the values that we believe in and the mission of our foundation. And because we fundamentally believe that the life that you lead, is the most authentic expression of who you really are. And we don't think that making excuses is justifiable. So I think that everybody needs to lead a life that they are proud about, given the circumstances. Doesn't have anything to do with rich or not rich. I have met very, very inspiring people in the slums of Mumbai. If they're not starving, if they have enough to eat, you know, that they are very happy people, very content people. And I've met many, actually the majority of wealthy people are not happy people because they are really worried of losing their wealth and they just really are warriors. And you see, I check with my doctor. So I go to the doctor once a year and I say, Dr. Emma, how are people feeling, right? And she says, Charlie, you wouldn't believe it, but this guy, you know, instead of having two jets, he only has one jet, and he is physically sick. So, you know, I mean, People, even with a lot of wealth, you don't understand it, but their subjective experience of how they feel, they're sick about that, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm not judging them. That's who they are. That's what they do, and then that's how it goes.
Mm-hmm. Wie funktionieren nun dieses soziale Investment? Mhm. Worauf bezieht sich der Impact und wie wird das auch konkret gemacht?
Ja.
Es gibt ja seit 2002 eine eigene Foundation, die KL Felicitas Glücksstiftung heißt das ja eigentlich,
ja.
Oder?
Ja.
Und unter dieser Foundation werden ja schon diese Investments, die versucht werden, beschrieben. Können wir da so einen kurzen Überblick haben?
Ja.
Was ist jetzt das Neue an diesen Investments, mit denen die Menschen glücklicher werden sollen?
Okay, so in 2000 we created the foundation, and the foundation's mission is to help social entrepreneurs and social enterprises go to scale, become more impactful, and also to then educate other foundations and other money sources of how to actually invest to have a positive impact. So when we started out, you know, we didn't really know how to do that yet. And so everybody who thinks about this should just start doing one or two investments, because it's very difficult to start understanding all the different asset classes like cash, equities, debt, right, commodities, public equities, and how to manage them according to impact. But maybe you're inspired by, let's say, what would be a good example, by helping social enterprises alleviate poverty in India or around the globe. And so you see what are the enterprises that you might find, and is there a way for you to actually invest in them some capital, and what return and impact can you expect? I'll give you an example. So, for instance, we found an organization called HealthPoint Services. And HealthPoint Services is a privately held company that provides four services to the rural populations in India, Mexico, and the Philippines. And the four services are, it provides access to doctors for the people who normally don't see doctors, right? And we do that. So they provide health points, which are physical houses where the patients go in. In these houses, we have a remote connection over internet to doctors who serve multiple villages, and we have a nurse in each one of these health points that works with the patients and the doctors to administer the consultation with the doctor. The second service that we provide in these health points is that if they need to buy any drugs, we provide drugs, cheap drugs, in these a pharmacy, if you wish, mm-hmm. in these health points. The third service that they provide is diagnostic tests. So you can draw blood and do 80% of the normal tests in the small. It's not really a clinic; it's a health point, right? And the fourth service is clean water. So the impact that these investments have, assuming that you can build, let's say, 100 of these health points, you can actually quantify quite easily how many touch points you have with how many patients per day, per week, and you can then measure their health and then do a longitudinal study and measuring their health next year and the year after. So we're doing that, and so it's the primary impact that you have is quite easily measurable. The primary impact being that many patient visits, that many liters of water being drawn. The secondary impact is sometimes a little bit harder to measure. You know, if because of clean water, do you actually avoid health issues? You do, right? But it's harder to prove. And so the investment side, so that's the impact side, right? And we are very bullish, very, very, very excited about that. Now, I decided to go on the board of this investment to represent an investor class of impact investors who put $600,000 of equity investment into this company. And as a board member, I'm directing the strategy, and I'm able to figure out now, I'm raising capital for this company. So we're raising $3 to $5 million in equity capital and about $3 million in debt capital to get this company to the next level of impact. And after that, we would have an exit strategy for investors where they can actually sell their shares either to insiders or to partners to get their money back. So this is an example where the impact is quite obvious, and the investment time frame may be 5 to 7 years, which is quite acceptable for an investor, even if you invest in any other non-impactful private company, right? So that's an example, hopefully, that shows you how healthcare, pharmacy, and water investment can be done while you expect the 8 to 9 to 10% return on the finances. That's the goal that we have. Are we going to be able to do that? Maybe, maybe not. I'm on the board, so I'm pretty hopeful. I'm not hopeful. I manage it. I'm like managing it actively on this instance. We always want to have somebody whom we trust very close to that investment. And that's either myself or somebody whom I worked with before on these very, very risky investments. And maybe a different example to give you sort of a different scope is, so if you reflect on land use, the way that land is used or not used or conserved by humanity going into the 21st century, having 9 billion people on the planet, then the extreme cases of overdevelopment of land or just reserving it for no development at all is something that we don't believe in anymore. And so our theory is we want to invest in land use that combines conservation with limited sustainable development. So we found a fund called Pertus Capital that does that in the U.S. It invests in ranch land, it buys it out, it uses, it sells part of the development rights to companies that care about that, they're grant funded, and so they put part of the land in perpetuity into conservation, meaning nobody else can develop it anymore over time. We care about that. But we don't want to, we also want to make some money. So we allow some limited developments, like maybe an eco lodge, or some smaller lodge, or some community center, or some private ranch that's not a huge mansion. And then this fund sells these developed, semi-developed properties to people who want to buy them. In this instance, people buy these ranches and pay significant money for that. That's why we get a significant financial return on that, not just the conservation return. So this is a theory of change, a theory that we have where we say combined land use is more sustainable than not combined land use. And so we measure the impact that this investment has we measure number of hectares conserved, number of miles of river conserved, right? That has a clear sustainability component that's actually ecological and not social in this instance. If we also combine that with a community center, which we like, then a social impact we measure as well, but not all of these investments actually do that. So those are two investments. Then we invest in carbon, we invest in biodiversity, we invest in commodities that nature seemingly provides us for free, but it's not. In the future, we have to pay for it, right? And so we are the early investors in these renewable timber. It's very important, you know, do we lose some return? Maybe. I don't know, right? But I would never be able to invest in non-renewable timber. I don't want my money to go in something that's bad for the, that's knowingly bad for the planet. A lot of investments, you don't know some of the side effects. But if I know about it, I don't do it.
Mhm. Was unterscheidet dieses Investment von den üblichen ethischen Investmentfonds, die es ja auch gibt?
Ja, es gibt viele der ethischen Investmentfonds gehören in die Kategorie von passively managed investments, meaning that they have a screen that they use to screen out investments. So the oldest ethical funds, you know, you could screen out investments in alcohol, tobacco, pornography, maybe nuclear energy, things of that nature, right? And you can say, part of the screen, I don't want my investment managers to invest in these companies because I believe they're bad. They're bad for humanity, or they're bad for whatever, for moral reasons or religious reasons, whatever your motivation is, right? And some of them go one step beyond that and say, within an investment theme, I want to select best in class. So that's almost moving from passively managed, meaning you don't actively invest in something that magnifies your intended impact, to, okay, let me analyze the whole sector, and instead of just saying I avoid companies that I invest in, I want to select the best ones according to a positive impact that you have. Impact investing goes one step beyond that and says, I actually want to actively select the companies and the phones that are aligned with the values that I believe in, as opposed to passively or just best of breed.
Ich habe mir das am Anfang, als ich das gehört habe, immer so erklärt, ist das richtig oder falsch? Wir haben hier in der Nähe am Fahrplatz einen Fairtrade-Handel.
Fairtrade, ja.
Ja, also dort werden Produkte hergestellt, die unter sozialen und ökologischen Kriterien mehr können als die, die bei H&M nebenan verkauft werden. Aber das ist so ein kleines Segment sozusagen in der gesamten Wirtschaft. Und das Anliegen von Social Impact Investing ist auch solche Produktionen auf ein Niveau zu bringen, dass es tatsächlich am Weltmarkt und in größeren, also als Mainstream im Idealfall bestehen kann und nicht als so eine kleine Spur von Idealisten. Ist das richtig, dass dann auch in solche Firmen investiert wird, die die man so nach betriebswirtschaftlichen Kriterien und nach Managementkriterien so weit fit macht, dass sie tatsächlich auch das können?
Ja. I think that's a great observation that you have, that you have, and that's really what are the distribution channels for products that were done by disadvantaged people, meaning people that are very, very poor, and you want to tie them into the global economy. I think Europe was at the forefront in actually doing retail chains, right, that were a channel for these products. Now, they never really scaled up to a significant level because they sold products that were mostly not desirable by the mainstream buyer, with exception for the social buyer who wants to support the social aspects of it. But they would not buy the goods in that shop because they want to buy them because they have to have them, right? They buy them for social motivation, and that means it's never going to scale. And so impact investors all over the world are actually providing mainstream distribution channels to these products that are produced by disadvantaged and poor communities. To give you an example, I have been working with a company called Industry Private Limited, which is a retail chain in India that has committed to doing 70% of the products that they sell in the retail stores that they have that are produced by disadvantaged producers. Now, in order to do that in a retail store that's very small margins from a profitability standpoint, who actually helps the producers to understand the designs that would be mainstream so that normal people would buy them because they desire to buy them, right? You cannot demand from the retail store to train the producers. Who helps the producers to actually change the designs depending on what our, you know, in winter we buy some different color schemes than in summer. And we understand that, but the women in the villages, they don't understand that. They don't know the color schemes of Mumbai and Delhi and us. And so the way that we handle this is actually that subsidized capital, including grants, does go to support the producers and help them actually do the capacity building for design consulting, for quality control, that otherwise they would not be able to do. Therefore, they're able to produce something that actually has the quality and the design constraints that the mainstream distribution channel, be that a retail store, a wholesale store, or online, or through intermediaries, or shop-in-shop, all valid distribution channels are valid. So the impact investors, they don't go and see only the producers or only the distribution channel. They see the whole value chain and the supply chain and make sure that it's aligned, because otherwise I would lose my investment, right, if I don't.
Mhm. Welche Investoren lassen sich denn schon überzeugen von dieser Idee und in welchen Dimensionen bewegt sich das momentan?
Yeah, you know, I have the best job in the world because I get to talk to young people who are motivated, and I go and talk to MBA students. Like tomorrow I go to the WU Wien, right, to talk to them, and usually, you know, after I talk to the young generation, at least 5 or 10, even in the hardcore MBA classes where they teach, the you know, the 1% of the population, how to maximize the return of the 10% of the population. That's their goal, right? And they don't teach them how to enable the people that I just talked about to participate in the economy. They don't teach them what social enterprises are all about. They don't teach them to go beyond GDP. They don't teach them how you measure impact and how you actually do a term sheet that includes that. They don't teach them how venture capital should be changed. They don't teach any of that, right? So we need to go and teach them in the non-universities. And I've worked with universities, you know, but the point that I wanted to make is that the young people actually, they have an intuition. They know they don't believe in the current system anymore. And I was delighted to see, you know, MBA students walk out of Harvard Business School, because the professor taught them the old non-sustainable stuff. They said, we don't believe you anymore. Look at what's going on with the models that you teach us, the externalities that I talked about before. This, it's not working, Mr. Professor, right? Teach us something that works. And it's not simple, because we need to co-create this right now. We need to reinvent not only capitalism, but how the financial industry works. And so the merchant banks will be replaced by impact merchant banks. The investment banks will be replaced by impact investment banks. And the intermediaries will be impact intermediaries, because in the end, if you do something that's not positively impactful, how can you do that? In 15 years, the CEO who willingly messes up the planet should go to jail, as far as I'm concerned, right? It's not acceptable. Yet everybody pretends as if it's acceptable. I don't get it, you know? Mm-hmm. It's like, why do we continue teaching the young people something that's not only not right, but clearly wrong? Mm-hmm. And I'm hopeful, because they start understanding. They ask the right questions. We need to enable them to be successful. They want to put $20, $25, $100 in supporting social enterprises. I don't think we have that here yet, but Kiva in the U.S., they allow, you know, my kids to make $2,500 investments in social entrepreneurs. Colorbird Foundation has a platform where you can deploy, you know, $100 and above into your social communities, and you get 2-3% return. It's better than putting it into the cash into your bank, right? It's not superior returns. And so the legislation starts enabling crowdfunding. So crowdfunding actually is enabling the crowd, we all, to put money to work, and you don't have to be an investment advisor anymore. So I see that change coming, and it's coming, you know, big time all over the world. And now let's go one segment up. Who are my peers, right? Are there investors who have more capital? So we can deploy hundreds of thousands of dollars, right, into an investment. And there are about 70 of us on the planet right now. And about 40 of them I'm already collaborating with. And I think there's another 40 that are active that we don't collaborate with yet. And that's a good start, but it's not the end, right? And so we showcase them, we document our deals. It's called Tonic, the network that we co-founded, T-O-N-I-I-C. You can look it up, tonic.com. And we've done 21 investments in the last 18 months, where mm-hmm. we syndicated capital, global capital, and global deals by radical transparency, radical sharing of information. We turn the model upside down. The current industry is not sharing at all, right? It's protective. It's my deal. It's not your deal. Now we open it up, say, this is our deal, right? So we change the attitude. We change the how we approach this. The real difficulty is to change the institutional capital, the big money guys. We are still, you know, our money in the end does not change the needle. But what we change is we prove, so we are transparent, because the big money needs proof points, otherwise it doesn't move. It's like doing startups, right? I'm a startup guy, so anything that I did in my life, you know, people always said it's impossible to do. Now they say it's impossible to tell you that you can change the banks. I say, no, it's not. In 5 years, 10 years, we're going to change it, right? And I'll show you how. And so now I get to talk to the ABN AMROs, you know, the Triodos banks, and the pension fund managers in Europe actually are a little bit advanced than the pension fund managers in the U.S. They hide behind the lawyers. They say fiduciary responsibility ends at the next quarter. In Netherlands, 3 months ago, I talked to somebody who said, Charlie, something really interesting happened recently. I had the pensioners, retired guys, right? Like myself, no, not really retired. So real retired guys who depend on the pension funds to give them money, right? So they depend on pension funds making money in order to give them money. If the pension funds are not capitalized correctly or lose money, then the pension systems break down, and most pension systems actually on the planet will predictably break down. So they are under a lot of stress. But they say now, the pensioners, the retirement guys, they tell me, they say, I really want my pension, but, you know, if you, by giving me the pension, mess up the planet for my grandkids, I want to talk to you about it. Now, that's for the first time somebody making the relationship between their entitlement to a pension and that the investment guys who manage the money, their money of the pensions, might actually mess up the planet for their grandkids, which is really happening, right? Now, that's an interesting correlation that you all participate in. Mm-hmm. So if you don't hold your pension funds accountable, who will, right? They will burn and slash and rape the lands of the, you know, of the globe, and you will benefit from it. Now, that doesn't sound good, right?
Okay. Ich schaue mal in die Runde, ob es schon Fragen gibt an Charlie. Wir haben unser Mikro, das immer herumgeht, bitte.
Do you think you can get the United States to think socially?
So my goal is not to think in nations anymore. I think the nations are really the wrong level of abstraction for social thinking. I think it's about humanity. And I think there's many, many, many good people in all nations of the world who think socially. And to me, it's actually to make sure that we all collaborate as human beings for each other. Now, the enabling, the regulatory environment is where I hold nations accountable for. And the regulatory environment needs to enable foundations to invest. It needs to enable incorporation models that go beyond the dichotomy between the not-for-profit and the for-profit incorporation model. And there, California and Delaware are actually leading edge. So we have, since about a year, we have a new incorporation model where you're actually not only held accountable towards your shareholders anymore, but also to the mission of the company. It's called B Corporation, A3C Corporation. And in Benelux, in Brussels, actually next month there is going to be an incorporation model that's going to be proposed for the European market that goes beyond maximizing profits. So those are nation responsibilities. But this, you know, to get, I think if people don't hold their governments accountable for implementing the right social programs, then it's not the government's fault, but the people's fault.
But your funds are under United States law, aren't they?
Different. So we invest in European funds as well. Triodos Bank is one of the most enlightened banks, and they're incorporated in the Netherlands, for instance, right? And HealthPoint Services is incorporated in Mauritius, the company I just told you about, right? And you can either invest in Mauritius or in a U.S. company that's a holding company for that. Mm-hmm. And the investments are done in entities that are all over the world, you know, but a lot of them are in the U.S., that's correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Und die, im Bankenbereich gibt es auch schon Banken, die sich ganz auf das spezialisiert haben?
Yeah, so there are actually banks that do that, and the most progressive ones, there's one in the Netherlands called Triodos Bank, and that's all they do. So everything that they do is with social impact. And they have a couple of funds. One is a sustainable trade fund that we invested in that provides financing to cooperatives in Africa and all over the world to give them financing while they produce the crops that they produce and the purchase order is placed, because otherwise they would have to sell right away. So there's very innovative, you know, things going on. There's a bank in Germany that does similar things. I just got to know them about them yesterday, but I forgot their name. That does the same thing. Mm-hmm. In the U.S., we have community foundation banks that are normal banks, but they according to a law that was done in the U.S. in the 80s, they're required to make loans to the disadvantaged communities within the poor cities of the U.S., for instance. And the investors, like myself, who put the cash to work in these banks, we get the same return. There's no more risk because they are insured by the federal government of the U.S. But I know that it has an impact. And versus if I give it to Bank of America or to Wells Fargo, I know that they use it to finance the wars, which I don't believe in. So I don't want to give it to that bank, even mm-hmm. if I get the same return financially. So it's a very easy thing to do.
Mm-hmm. And boom.
Yeah. Oh,
yeah.
Sorry.
To conserve soil or to produce sustainable timber is expensive. And how can you sell this sustainably produced timber on the worldwide market?
Mm-hmm. So I think sustainable timber, as you point out, requires many different constituencies to collaborate in making it work and get financial return. So it requires that, first of all, if you cut down timber, like I said before, and you don't replace it, it's not counted positively from an accounting standpoint. Number two, you have to have verifiable independent auditors, if you wish, who say, I validate that this timber is sustainably harvested, and they give an independent stamp to that, because without an independent auditor, how would you trust the producers, right? Number three, you have to educate the importers and the big distributors and the big retail stores that they have sustainable timber as part of their offerings. And in California, for instance, there's 20% of the population that would pay between 10 and 20% more for sustainable timber than non-sustainable timber. I don't know how much it is in Austria, right? But that's a big market. 20% of the Californian market is something that gets the attention of everybody because they want to serve that market. And if we have a 20% market in Europe who cares on the buying side that they may be for temporary for 5-10 years until the system adjusts, right, and actually it flips, that's what it takes. So it's a combination of things and not one silver bullet, unfortunately, right? There's no simple answer to that.
Okay, so you have to do hard work to educate the people.
Yeah.
To
and lobby. So we might invest in lobbying organizations that do an education, right, or that put pressure on legislation to maybe mandate that 20%, like in California, as in Europe, you know, right now California has to use 30% renewable energy. It has by law. There's no choice, right? And so there's not enough renewable energy produced in California. So what the consequence is that we import energy from neighboring states. We have to. That's produced renewably. Now, over time, since there's a market in California, the market will adjust, and more renewable energy will be produced in California for California, which is what you want, ultimately, right? And so in California, we instituted a law where certain producers are held accountable financially for cradle-to-cradle processes for certain products. They have to accept the waste. They cannot, you know, back for free into their companies. They have to collect the waste. They're required by law to do that. They cannot say no. So you want to work top-down, right, while you work bottom-up on educating the consumers, and you then enforce legislation and the validation and verification through independent auditors.
Mm. But you need a lot of change in legislation to have the ability to compete with a non-sustainable produced
well,
goods.
They always say that, right? And I mean, that's why Detroit had to be refinanced by the U.S. taxpayers, because they said, wrongly so, that they cannot compete with the world market, with the world car market, if they don't get the subsidies and can continue producing these god-awful SUVs, right? Now, they were wrong. And had they been forced by legislation to actually become more cost-effective and compete on the global market with cost-effective cars, they would have avoided that mess and would not have had to be bailed out. Mm-hmm. So here you see, you know, how it actually worked.
Können wir das vielleicht kurz auch für eine Laien wie mich auseinandernehmen noch einmal? Wie verdient man mit dieser Form von Investment jetzt Geld? Wenn ich jetzt auch diesen Diskurs richtig verstanden habe, dann geht es ja noch darum, dass man das überhaupt alles marktfähig macht, dass man das konkurrenzfähig macht. Es gibt ja auch Konkurrenz für solche Investments, oder? Lässt man ihnen da einfach das Feld? Sagt man einfach, ja, ist eh okay, macht ihr das, verdient dort gutes Geld? Oder muss man nicht damit rechnen, dass man da mal eine Zeit lang auch weniger verdient oder gar nichts verdient oder möglicherweise das Geld in den Sand setzt? Wo kommt die Rendite her? In diesem Stadium der Entwicklung? Yeah.
So we try to avoid the risk of actually losing all of our money, and so we would not invest in something where, except for that small pocket where we invest in individual companies. So to be concrete, Lisa and I, we do 5 investments per year, maybe $50,000 to $100,000 in 5 individual companies where we might lose everything, right? But that's only a small portion of our waste. So if indeed we lose a majority of this, but we also make 7, 8, 9% positive return on the rest of the portfolio, we are okay with that. Most investors are not okay with that. They want to maximize everything, right? But to me, it's why would I, if I could make 10% vis-a-vis 9% over, 9% vis-a-vis 10% over the whole portfolio, and I have a huge social impact, I rather have 9% and a huge social impact than 10% and no impact. And that's only 70 people think like myself on that one yet, right? Because most people want to maximize their financial return. Now, I do want to have a financial return, but I don't want to maximize it. So what I say is, how can I make sure, that I get 6, 7, 8%? And so if you look into our portfolio, how it behaved in 2008 and 2009. So for those of you who have money and you invested it in 2008 and 2009, it was not very happy years. Because you would have lost quite a bit of your capital if you were invested in equity, for instance, because the equity markets all over the world lost 40% on average. So now you look into our portfolio and you see that we invested 10% of our portfolio in microfinancing institutions, right? So microfinancing institutions were in financiers of microfinanciers, right? Or funds that invest in microfinancing institutions, which invest in social entrepreneurs, were not correlated to the subprime, to the meltdown in the financial markets. If you remember, everything was correlated, so there's no way to hide your money somewhere and not lose, unless you were in cash or in not correlated money. And so, interestingly enough, the impact investments that we did provided +5, +6% return in 2008 and 2009. Now, why was that the case? Because they're not part of the global market that had the meltdown. So I make the argument, sometimes with the normal investment crowd, that it's a hedge. You don't even have to be a soulful person. You just have to be afraid of the next big crisis to understand that you want to hedge, right? So I can put the fear argument into there as opposed to the being enlightenment argument, and it starts making sense. Because so many people, fear. Most people are very fearful, it's for whatever reason, and so I think if you make that argument, so microfinancing, right? You see how you make the returns, mm-hmm. and to your question, that's why I bring it up. You can make 5-6% return. It's almost like an absolute return strategy if it's good or bad. Now, if the markets go up 20%, 25%, you see, then the people say, oh, you left money on the table, right? Mm-hmm. Why didn't you invest in the growth? And I say, well, I'm more happy with impact and a constant 6% return, for part of my portfolio. And then I take risks, let's say, with carbon investments. So I think that carbon, will be regulated even in the U.S. eventually, right? And we do it in California now. And if a carbon market coming online in 2013, that's a leading indicator for the U.S. because 3-4 years later, usually the U.S. then follows California's lead and we'll have it. So we invest ahead of the curve where institutional capital is too risky for it to go in.
Mm-hmm. Als wir das letzte Mal im Vorjahr gesprochen hatten, da gab es doch auch gerade Gespräche, wenn ich mich erinnere, zum Beispiel mit der Rockefeller Foundation. Mm-hmm. Kann man solche Institutionen schon gewinnen für diese Idee? also diese wirklich großen.
So, since you tape this, you know, I don't think that they're going to find it online. So. Well, the Rockefeller Foundation is interesting because they actually funded a lot of the impact investing research and impact investing frameworks and impact investing organizations that provided standards, but their organization themselves is not an impact investor. So it's they get and they should get criticism for why do they preach and then don't invest their own money into impact. And they're starting to do this now, but they're not leaders in this space. However, one leadership investment that they did together with the K.L. Felicitas Foundation, so I get to say K.L. Felicitas and Rockefeller in one sentence, right? That's cool. Invested in an instrument in the UK that's called social impact bonds. And social impact bonds is the first instrument that explicitly correlates the social impact that the investment has with the return. So you get more financial return if you have a bigger social impact. The topic that they've chosen to implement this with is called recidivism rate, which is Rückfallquote for offenders in the prison system, right? So in the UK prison system, about 40% of male offenders go back to prison within 12 months that they are released. It's an enormous cost to society. And so if we could lower this, the society, the taxpayer, would save a lot of money. And so the idea is that they put an independent company in place that accepts money from people like me and the Rockefeller Foundation, and then they work with the NGO sector to work with the offenders that come out of the prison. They coach them, they mentor them, they help them get jobs, they help them, you know, attack their addiction to alcohol or drugs, which a lot of them have. And by these interventions, hopefully, we can lower the recidivism rate from 40% to 20%, right? If we were to do that, then I get 13% return financially. If we only lower it...
Aber von wem? Wer bezahlt das?
The government.
The government.
Yeah, because it saves so much taxpayers' money, right? So he can say to the taxpayer, look, I save you X amount of dollars, so we incentivize. Now, however, if we don't lower it by at least 7.5% in this particular instance, I would lose all my money. So that's, mm-hmm. You know, we're working on that for the next. In order to scale it up, you probably have to redo that. So now these social impact bonds, they're being deployed in Massachusetts, you know, the U.S., to address homelessness and put bonds out there that say, in order, if you could avoid the homeless, go to the emergency healthcare system in the U.S., which they do. It costs the state an enormous amount of money. And by putting shelters in place that actually do provide health care as well, you can make the legitimate argument that you can pay back the investor on that level. So you see how you correlate social impact with financial return, which ultimately you have to do in order to move mainstream forward. So those are signs. I can see not a wave coming, but a wavelet out there, you know, that we can invest in. For social injustices, right, and social impact.
Okay. Bitte. Darf ich?
Oh no! Now we go to this part of the room. No. Is there a question? No question. No, sorry. Okay, it's you. All right.
I'm so sorry, but...
No, it's okay, unless somebody else wants to speak
to,
up.
To get the return on investment of, as you said, 9% is a very optimistic aim in times like these. How do you want to get this money back? Do you want to get it back from the women in India, or do you want to get it back from other investors who begin to be interested in this type of investment?
You mean from other investors? To get money back from other investors?
Yeah. This is a little bit like a Ponzi system.
No. Yeah, I don't understand. So we don't get money back from other investors. We invest and get money back from the investee. So I don't quite understand what you want to say.
Well, you help. You told us you invested in a company who helps women in India to produce goods.
Yeah, so that's one investment that provides some return, right? So So, okay. So clearly we do that, and others like this. Okay. And what's the other point?
And yeah. Do you want to get this money from these women?
So the company...
Somebody has to pay for that.
So the company, right, HealthPoint Services, that's the example. HealthPoint Services requires that the clients pay, yes.
Okay.
And so they have to pay, yes. I don't believe that handouts are good at all. I'm really very much against that. Now, how much they pay is very important. And so for the drugs that we sell, you know, we maintain price control, so they get them much cheaper than if they had to go to a pharmacy. For the consultation with the doctors, we charge them 50 cents a consultation, which if they have to go to the town, they would have to pay the equivalent of $2.50 to get to town, to have the consultation and come back. So it's a very good deal for them, but they have to pay. If they don't pay, I don't have the impact and I don't get the return. That's clear.
Okay, that's a good idea. To get the money from the doctors and the pharmacists and so on.
Yeah. And for the water, they have to pay 75 rupees a month for the water. For 20 liters a day, we have to charge them, otherwise I don't know how to scale. Just think about the capital expenditure to do, you know, one water point is $10,000. So you do the math. If you want to do 10,000 water points, there's no way that you can raise grant money that much. It's not out there. So if you don't have a social enterprise, it's not going to work.
Wir hatten ja gerade im Zusammenhang mit den Mikrokreditprogrammen gerade in letzter Zeit auch sehr viel Kritik an dieser Art von Investment, weil man gesagt hat, damit werden, so haben Sie es wahrscheinlich jetzt auch ein bisschen im Hintergrund gehabt, sozusagen die arme indische Bäuerin wird so unter Druck gesetzt, dass es sogar Selbstmorde gibt, weil man diese gut gemeinten Kredit in Wirklichkeit dann auch wieder ausnützt und es verdient daran eine Bank, aber nicht die Frau. Was unterscheidet euer Investment von dieser Art, wie sie von Mohammed Yunus zum Beispiel vertreten wird?
So that's a very good question. And so if you look at microfinancing today, then there's really three segments of the market of how microfinance works. Now the top segment where you can make the most financial returns, they are actually regulated as banks now. They're not a not-for-profit. So these microfinancing institutions, they get the license to actually accept money as savings from their customers, and that requires usually a banking license, so they have to become a for-profit. And then they, the best of the best, they actually have a chance of going public now. So there's two companies that recently went public in that sector, Compartamos in Mexico and SKS in India, and they got criticized by many, many people who say that they try to maximize the return of their investors who invested in them at the expense of lowering the rate that they charge the lenders. And you can make that argument, and partially it's true, partially it's not true. It depends on how much competition there is. But certainly there's pressure towards the investors, just like there's pressure to have a competitive product. We invest in those because we think that they serve a great purpose, and they actually attract a lot more capital. And a lot more capital, we believe, results in providing services to many, many more clients that otherwise are not served. Because remember, these clients still cannot get access to the main banks, right? So they serve a purpose. Now, the middle segment of the market is usually a hybrid model, where they might not be organized as a bank yet, but as a for-profit and a not-for-profit. And we invest in that as well because we believe that they serve a good purpose that the top tier does not serve. And then there's the bottom tier, which is usually not-for-profits that require grant capital only. We don't support them because we only have limited capital and we believe in Blended. It's not that they don't do good work. They should be supported, but we decided not to support them. Mm-hmm. And so you see, you have to have a differentiated argument when you say, oh, all microfinancing is bad. It's not true, right? It depends on what you think. There's many, many, many great ones. It is true, however, that in India particularly, too much money moved into microfinancing, and there were issues about that. And whenever you have mainstream capital coming in big mainstream capital, you have an overhang of capital that usually requires some cleanup. So it's a normal development, just like in clean tech. In the 90s, the venture capital guys of Silicon Valley, they went into clean tech big time, right? And you had an overhang, and the first funds didn't make any money because there was too much money in it, and the valuations of the companies, investors paid too much for those investments.
Mm-hmm. Es gibt ja eine große Reihe von sogenannten Entwicklungshilfeorganisationen, die ja versuchen, auch zum Beispiel Gesundheitsversorgung, ja. Wasser, eine Form von Handwerksbetrieben, Handel und so weiter aufzuziehen. Warum funktioniert das nicht? Warum verändert sich dadurch die Welt nicht wirklich?
You know, I thought about this a lot, of whom to partner with, and if you think about how hard it is to enable these fledgling enterprises go to scale, it's a combination of things. First of all, the people who do it, they are not trained managers. They don't even understand, you know, a P&L, profit and loss statement. They don't understand a cash flow statement. They don't understand what managing towards cash flow break-even even means, right? And so, which is necessary to have a discipline of scaling any impact, in my opinion, unless you're only grant-based. And if you're only grant-based, then it's a very limited amount of impact that you can have. And so most of the old development money is actually going into grants only. Let's take the example of the producers again, right? And you say, okay, a lot of foundations work that way. A lot of development organizations work that way. Let's just help these poor women in the producer communities and give them grants and throw more grants at them, and magically they would discover the markets for it. It doesn't happen. You have to blind leading the blind. The development organizations don't know how the distribution channels work. They never worked in one. How many not-for-profit distribution channels actually scaled up globally? Not many, right? Mm-hmm. And so they then consult, not knowing how to do that themselves, with the poor producers, and very predictably, you know, as soon as they go away, the whole system collapses and the poor women, you know, have lost their livelihoods. Mm-hmm. And so if you don't take responsibility for end-to-end and hooking them up with the... Because they think that the for-profit distribution channels are evil. So there's a lot of things where the not-for-profit sector and the foundations and the philanthropists say, oh, you make profits, that's bad, right? And so that's where I'm coming in and say, no, limited profits, incentivized profits is a good thing. Extreme profits is not a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Was denkst du über das Thema Wachstum?
Well, so scaling has to be reframed as sustainable scaling, and that's a very difficult subject because if you think about how the human nature works, then we compare how the human brain works. We compare ourselves against our peers, not against non-peers. That's why, you know, the wealthy want to be more wealthy because they compare themselves to the wealthy peers, not to somebody who doesn't have any money. And so the competition and how the humans' evolutions have made humans is that we need to thrive on this level of competition. And right now, most of that competitive thinking is channeled into having more status symbols, being better, having bigger things, more material expressions of who we are, and compare that to our peers. So I think we need to reframe that discussion and that perception, because human brains need to have competition and they need to compare themselves, unless we upgrade humanity to, you know, the next humanoids. Until we have the same brains, you know, we need to do that. But if we could reframe that and compare ourselves to being more sustainable, to be more impactful, right? And be thrilled about this and say, oh, I'm more impactful than you are on this one, right? So feel good about it, it's competition a little bit. I think that might be one way of solving that inherent dilemma without having to retreat and become a monk, you know, mm-hmm. and enlightenment.
Also das heißt Wachstum, ja, aber mit diesen sozialen und ökologischen Implikationen.
And human implications. And you cannot say that GDP growth is a bad measure of growth right now. So if you don't change GDP, Bruttonationalprodukt, do something else. So I advocate, you know, the Bhutanese got it right. They measure national happiness, national human well-being. How to measure that? That has to be the ultimate metrics of success. If you don't do that, I mean, it's proven in the U.S. for somebody, they become more happy if they get more money up until $70,000 per person. We know that if you earn more than 70,000, you're not getting more happy. We know that. We have done the studies. In Europe, it might be slightly less, right? And so why don't we change the system then of how we compare ourselves and how we measure this and enable more happiness and hold our governments accountable for creating more human well-being. And so that's one of the objectives that I have is changing GDPs, but I'm not working on that yet.
Mm-hmm. Gibt es irgendwo für diese Idee schon Verbündete? Wenn ich denke, wir leben ja in einer Welt, die sehr stark davon lebt, dass es Persönlichkeiten gibt, die für eine bestimmte Idee stehen, die auch eine bestimmte Haltung transportieren, ob das Prominente sind, Politiker oder bestimmte Investoren. Ist da auf internationaler Bühne schon irgendjemand sichtbar, außer Charlie Gleisner, der diese Idee tatsächlich auch so promotet, dass die Investoren, die nicht ganz vorne dabei sein wollen, sagen, okay, jetzt probiere ich das auch einmal?
It's very early days on that one. And I think that we're just seeing some people step forward. And you saw Bill Gates stepping forward and saying you should donate, you know, half of your stuff to charities. I believe that's the wrong approach. But since I worked for Steve Jobs, I'm biased maybe because Bill Gates is copying, you know, what he does and enhancing it. So he's copying the old model of philanthropy and enhancing it, but he's not turning it upside down. That's why I'm so sad that Steve passed away, because I think that he would have had a chance to rethink philanthropy on a fundamental level. However, you know, I just saw that club of billionaires, the biggest topic in their last meeting, which was in Mexico, I think, was impact investing. So that's a good sign, right? And so if they could recast handing out, billions of dollars to actually having impact investments over the next 2-3 years, great. Gates Foundation 10 years ago was in the news of not doing any impact investing. As a matter of fact, they were in the news of having investments that directly contradict, you know, their desire to do good. Mm-hmm. And it was a fundamental, you know, so that it's a reputational risk for the trustees of their foundation. And that actually got them going. So now, to their credit, they've invested $400 million into impact. Mm-hmm. So, but it's, they're not first movers. They never were, even in the for-profit side, right? But they are good copiers. So if we produce something that they can copy, which is the strategy, that's how we do it. Mm-hmm. So we are the innovators, right? And we test out these models, and if the system doesn't collapse before that, then they can copy it. If the system, you know, changes significantly, we have prototypes of how we could do it as the system recovers in a different form. Mm-hmm. That's how we do it.
Mm-hmm. Wie viel Geld sollte man momentan haben, wenn man bei euren Investments mitmachen möchte?
So Tonic is for $25,000 two investments per year as a minimum entry point. Mm-hmm. And so that's so that way we can deploy, we think, you know, multiples of $50,000 give you per investment between $200,000 and $600,000, which would be a good startup capital for investments. Now that's going to be complemented by crowd funding platforms where we can invest less over time.
Wie ist denn das Interesse verteilt zwischen Europa und Amerika? Also wenn ich dich jetzt wieder reden höre, dann habe ich den Eindruck, das ist doch eine sehr durch Amerika geprägte Weltsicht auch, oder? Dass man das Unternehmertum eigentlich sozusagen die schönste Tugend ist, die der Mensch zur Verbesserung der Welt einsetzen kann. Das ist in Europa nicht unbedingt so der Stand der Dinge. Gibt es da auch unterschiedliche Einstellungen dann zu dieser Form von Social Impact Investment oder gibt es sogar andere Ideen, die das modifizieren?
Mm-hmm. There is a difference between the European scene and the US scene. So the US ecosystem of impact investors were the first ones to actually say, let's do something together, right? And co-create this, because they are more entrepreneurial. They say, okay, it's not there, so let's go and create that. Having said this, the investors and the money is here in Europe, and they take a little bit more time to commit to participating, but we have great members now that actually, do that. So once that you get them over the hump, they might even have a bigger motivation than the U.S., but it's not as entrepreneurial. Now, there's also nascent moves. So I recently had the first co-investment done by a very, very prominent European family that's behind the Carrefour, success story. And they did a co-investment in a seedlings company and in Rwanda, where we produce much better seeds and seedlings and plant materials than is available right now in Rwanda, and therefore we can the local population can produce 40-45% more fruits and plants that they need to have regional production for regional consumption, which is one of the sustainability objectives that we have. Now the term sheet that we put together, however, was floated by this family and their lawyers, and their whole lawyer staff descended on us and just really wanted to change it to a term sheet that's very much non-social and not impactful, right? So whenever we do these investments, we have to educate everybody around how we do this, and it's just what we need to do, right? Because even if we have our group of impact investors, if we invite others to participate, they don't have the knowledge yet of what that means. And then if we have exit strategies and need to, whom do we go out? On Health Point, I have the pharmaceutical industry circulating above my head and wanting to throw out millions of dollars. Do I want to sell to them? No. I mean, that would be the end of the mission, right? I have the others that I can't name circling since I'm raising money, right? And wanting to invest. And so you see, it's not that simple to have investors who actually don't want to maximize the everything out of you ultimately. In Health Point, do I want to partner with somebody who just wants to use us as a distribution channel into all of our water points? That's their motivation. So I have to say no to that capital, right? Mm-hmm. So we need to align so it's as bad to accept non-aligned capital, right, as it is to not accept any.
Mm-hmm. Also wenn da jetzt jemand diese $25,000 pro Jahr hätte hier im Raum, was könnte oder sollte er tun, um das bei euch investieren zu können?
Well, then we embrace you and put you into our network, and the European director of Tonic is in Vienna. His name is Nicolas Hutter. We have an onboarding process. We pair you up with other investors. We show you, first you don't have to pay any membership. We just see if you actually like it or not, and then if you get value out of it, then we make you a member, and you have to pay $5,000 membership per year, and then you co-invest. The magic is really between members. So we have members that are doing very interesting stuff. I love to talk to other members because they all do very innovative activities. And so...
Das sind auch Unternehmer im Wesentlichen, die da dabei sind, oder?
Yeah, so LGT, not only, so LGT Social Ventures out of Switzerland is one of them. Mm-hmm. Prince Max's, social side. He gets criticized a lot that it's a greenwashing, social washing of his bank. Be that as it may, the LGT Social Venture guys are doing good work, right? And they are part of Tonic. Quadia is a small investment consulting company out of Switzerland again, and they consult with Swiss back offices and want to deploy their capital into impact deals. So those are not individuals, but they represent bigger money. Then we have François Buchhape. He's obviously from Netherlands, and he is himself. He is a they call us high net worth individuals or ultra high net worth individuals, HNIs. And he's an HNI out of Brussels. And so he, you know, we collaborate on the FAME deal, for instance. The Rundon deal, so he brings capital into that. So he, so recently Tonic was interested in figuring out how crowdsourcing and crowdfunding works. And so we checked out who is doing crowdsourcing, crowdfunding, and we invest in Purpose.com, which is a very innovative company out of the U.S. That does campaigns and modern campaigns across the globe. Campaigns that, for instance, I don't know if you remember, the Ugandan parliament wanted to instantiate a really awful law that not only discriminates against homosexuals, but really makes them criminals. And so they had a campaign organized that resulted in them not doing this law. And even Hillary Clinton put pressure based on that campaigning, which is done in a modern way with social media, with Facebook Plus, right? And so that's, we get to see all these great things that are going to come down the pipe, right? That enables collaboration, you know, in a Facebook Plus way across the globe in activism. Mm-hmm. In activism that cares about impact.
Braucht dieses Social Impact Investment auch noch, würde sagen, so ordnungspolitische Rahmenbedingungen? Wir diskutieren ja immer wieder auch, wie der Finanzmarkt reguliert werden soll, ob es Finanztransaktionssteuern gibt, wie Investments steuerlich behandelt werden. Über die Politik haben wir in diesem Zusammenhang jetzt überhaupt noch nicht gesprochen. Braucht es oder wäre es politisch auch interessant, andere ordnungspolitische Rahmenbedingungen für solches Investment zu schaffen, es steuerlich in irgendeiner Form zu begünstigen zum Beispiel?
It would be, and so the particularly the way that foundations are regulated in Europe is very different than they are regulated in the US, for instance. So in the US you cannot use a foundation as a tax haven and pay yourself. It's not legal, it's not allowed, right? Versus the law in, at least in Germany and Austria, is such that you can create the foundation and you can actually pay yourself out of the foundation without doing anything, you know, without doing anything good or impactful, right? And so so one of the questions for the philanthropy sector in Europe is, would the EU and impact investing benefit from strengthening some laws about doing these types of foundations, normalizing the foundations. In some jurisdictions in Europe, in some instances, foundations are not allowed to do impact investments. So those are things that can be fixed from a regulatory standpoint and a law perspective top-down and should be fixed.
Gut, ich schaue noch einmal in die Runde.
Ice cubes, you need, yeah.
Sie haben vorher gesagt, Sie würden gerne das BIP austauschen gegen sowas wie einen Happiness-Faktor. Ja? Wie sehr korreliert die wirtschaftlichen Voraussetzungen, die eine Person hat oder vielleicht eine Nation hat, wirklich mit Happiness? Weil ich glaube, das glücklichste Volk ist ja was in den Bhutan oder irgendwo, wie liest man ja immer wieder, und das sind ja nicht gerade die reichsten Menschen der Welt. Also würde mich interessieren, wie da die Korrelation oder Zusammenhang ist. Ja?
I'm not aware of the GDP per se and the correlation, negative or positive, to happiness. I am aware of the Gini coefficient, which is a coefficient that measures disparity of income, and there is a correlation. The more disparity you have, meaning the top 1% from the bottom 10%, the less happy the society is. That has been established. And I was just really intrigued by the fact that there's only a 3.8 times difference in between the top 20% and the bottom 20% in Austria, for instance, which is very, very low. So Austria should be a very happy nation based on that, right? It's not that simple, obviously, but that is one leading indicator. I think my comment about the GDP was not so much correlated to happiness, but with respect to sustainable growth and what that means, which translates indirectly into happiness, I think, but not directly correlated. there are, you know, there's multiple efforts going on that level. So Rio is happening next week, Rio plus 20. Mm-hmm. That's 20 years after the first Rio Sustainability Congress. I just talked on the way over to somebody who is writing a paper for that conference that shows the results of the happiness indices that have been done in Bhutan and four or five other nations, which I'm not aware of. I'm not an expert in this, but it's moving forward also. Even France is measuring that, right? And I'm proposing, so I'm coming from an effort called, what's it called now? Austria 32 or whatever. And we think about what Austria should look like in 2032, in 20 years from now. And I just made that proposal today that we should look into that. Mm-hmm.
Können wir vielleicht noch ganz kurz auf die Frage nach den Kriterien zum Abschluss noch einmal kommen? Wir haben jetzt gesagt, es soll diese ganzen Kriterien geben und diese Investments sollen auch möglichst transparent gehandelt werden. Wie kann man denn nun tatsächlich diesen Impact nachvollziehen, messen, auch garantieren den Investoren?
Yeah, so measurement of impact and what level of metrics do you want to use, what level of standards do you want to use? And it's a very important question because in the end, if we are not able to measure it and compare it, we will not succeed, right? And so then the question is, okay, how do you define your impact? Do you define it in terms of jobs created, in terms of income generated, in terms of land saved or whatever it is, right? And if you use one of these metrics, how do you define that metrics? So there is a standard evolving to define the semantics of the metrics themselves. So if you say I created 10,000 jobs and you compare that to you saying I created 5,000 jobs and we use the job definition of a standard, a job definition is a full-time job across around the year as opposed to half-time job or seasonal job or whatever, right? So everybody has to translate jobs into a normalized form. So that has happened, and it's a first step to actually be able to compare. Because even if I said, like, you know, I saved that many trees and you define trees differently, then we cannot compare things. If I say, you know, I am providing water to X number of people, then I can say, how much does it cost me to provide, you know, water to one family over 1 year or one, you know, day or 1 week? And then I want to invest in the ones that where I get more bang for the buck because I only have limited funds, right? And so that's where we want to go ultimately. So there's a lot of, how do we decide? I give an example of how KL Felicitas Foundation decides what to measure and how we measure it. We have three types of different metrics, and you can look this up online. We are a case study for Rockefeller Foundation and GIN. And so the first set of metrics is five that we use across our portfolio. And it measures indeed number of clients served and percentage of income elevated over time period, money raised, new capital coming in, revenue and profitability, right? And so five or six metrics, three of them are actually financial metrics because we believe that having more capital available at the right time for you is a leading indicator of having more impact. In 3 years, I can come back and prove it to you or not because I have 2 years of data now, right? And hopefully in 3-4 years, we have more data that proves that. Then the second type of metrics that we have is for sectors like water, health, we have water and health specific metrics. Again, four or five of those. The third piece is really qualitative metrics that are not quantifiable as easily. So we say KL Felicitas Foundation wants to invest in first time fund managers that don't attract the big capital yet, but where $500,000 investment makes a big difference to them, and if they can prove their model, then in the next iteration, they can actually raise an order of magnitude more capital. We have done this with three investments and have had success with that. And there's actually a fourth metric that we ask the investee and say, if we haven't asked you to report on something, what do you report on? What do you care about? Because if you care about it so deeply, I want to know about it and augment that to the reporting structure. And so you see that indeed we use metrics and say that they're a leading indicator for impact. What we cannot do is we cannot fall into the same fallacy as the financial-only folks that actually, in my opinion, confuse, you know, the PE ratios with the reality on the ground, right? They think actually that that is the company if they look at the financials. They don't differentiate anymore between they're looking at the financials. They think it's the reality, right? And we need to say, no, these are proxies. Are they useful? We think they are useful. Are they 100% reflecting the impact that you want to achieve? No. For those who really want to know, I tell them, go meditate for 6 weeks and you see the causal relationship between things.
Mm-hmm. Also meditieren hilft auch bei investieren.
Yes.
Okay.
Pray.
Pray, yeah, meditate and pray. Man kann irgendwie nicht übersehen, dass Sie doch aus dem heiligen Land Tirol kommen, gell?
Now I'm getting hot.
Es wird immer heißer. Ich denke, wir sind ohnehin am Ende unserer Zeit. Ich mache Sie gerne noch aufmerksam auf die nächsten Veranstaltungen im Kepler-Salon. Am kommenden Donnerstag mittags um 12.30 Uhr wandern wir in das Stifterhaus gemeinsam zu Mittag bei Stifter. Da ist die Autorin Katharina Riese zu Gast und es hat das Thema Wiederlesen, 12.30 Uhr im Stifterhaus. Und am kommenden Montag, 19.30 Uhr, unser Thema der veröffentlichte Raum. Stefan Dösinger spricht zu diesem Thema. Er ist Herausgeber von Architektur und Design. Wenn Sie noch Mitglied des Freundeskreises werden möchten, dann können Sie das auch heute Abend gerne wieder werden. Der Freundeskreis, der den Kepler-Salon sehr unterstützt. Und hier ist ein Vorstandsmitglied, das immer Beitrittserklärungen, glaube ich, in der Tasche hat. Gell?
Zufällig.
Zufällig, genau. Ich danke Ihnen, dass Sie da waren. Danke, Charlie Gleisner, für diesen Besuch hier in Linz. Du hast selbst gesagt, es ist noch ein recht frühes Stadium von diesen ganzen Investments und mir selbst geht es so, dass ich vom Herzen das sehr gut nachvollziehen kann und denke, dass ich habe leider nicht $25,000 pro Jahr übrig, die ich da investieren könnte. Aber dass ich auch den Eindruck habe, es wird noch ein bisschen dauern, bis sich hier etwas tut. Und dieser Eindruck ist so zwischen Hoffen und Bangen. Denn einerseits finde ich es für die Welt eine sehr gute Perspektive, dass wir unsere Art zu wirtschaften ändern. Auf der anderen Seite bin ich dann auch wieder ein bisschen pessimistisch, ob die Menschheit zu so viel Vernunft fähig ist, die man dann doch auch wieder dazu braucht, um das ernst zu nehmen. Mhm. Aber am Ende gibt mir dann Hoffnung. Ich denke, Charlie Gleisner ist für mich ein Mann, der immer vorne dabei ist. Zuerst bei der technischen Revolution in Silicon Valley. Warum sollte, wenn wir schon die Technik der Welt verändert haben, nicht auch die Wirtschaft der Welt veränderbar sein.
Sehr gut.
In diesem Sinne, vielen Dank fürs Kommen und viel Erfolg für die weitere Arbeit am Social Impact Investment. Danke vielmals.
Dankeschön.